This is the 24th broadcast in the America Looks Ahead series, presented by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current world affairs. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. The 21 republics of the Western Hemisphere are engaged today in a cooperative attempt to keep the European war from our shores. Mr. John I.B. McCulloch, Latin American Associate of the Foreign Policy Association and editor of its Pan-American News Service, will discuss the American republics face the war. Mr. McCulloch.
Good afternoon. Events in the inter-American field have moved with extraordinary rapidity since last autumn. And if these events have been less spectacular than some which have occurred in Europe, their long-term significance cannot be disregarded. Moreover, important decisions are now impending. In Rio de Janeiro, seven international lawyers from seven American republics have been considering ways and means to make effective the famous neutrality zone proclaimed last October at Panama. Word has just arrived from Rio that at long last a tangible proposal has been prepared by this committee of legal experts. Meanwhile, the spread of military aggression in Europe has focused attention on the question of territorial transfers within the Western Hemisphere. And in Washington, a permanent inter-American committee is awaiting reaction to a project of unusual scope and significance, the Inter-American Bank. The declaration of a neutrality zone emerged, as you perhaps remember, from a meeting of the American foreign ministers in the city of Panama shortly after hostilities broke out in Europe. The American republics marked out a zone extending from their shores for an average width of 300 miles. This was to be a zone of peace, and belligerents were requested to commit no acts of war within these waters. The idea behind this unique document was brought to Panama by the United States delegation. Ever since it was committed to paper, international lawyers have been wrangling over its validity. Critics of the doctrine admit that there is nothing sacrosanct about the traditional 3-mile limit, which merely happens to represent the maximum range of cannon fire at the time that the classical texts on international law were written. But they assert that no such profound change in the rules can be accomplished by a unilateral declaration. They contend, moreover, that this bold innovation is more likely to lead the American nations into war than to protect them from its ravages. Champions of the doctrine deny that this danger exists. They declare, furthermore, that the proclamation of the zone is to be welcomed precisely because it goes beyond outworn legalistic formulae. They maintain that warring nations have had their innings long enough, and that it is high time that neutral nations should assert and perhaps enforce their own terms. At the time that the declaration was drawn up, it was hoped that the European belligerents would consider it a reasonable request, and that they would recognize the desirability of abiding by its provisions. Actually, as you know, the answers received from the belligerents have been so hedged about with conditions as to amount to politely worded refusals. And it cannot be denied that patent violations of the neutrality zone have occurred. Through the President of Panama, whose office acts as a sort of clearinghouse for the American republics, the 21 American nations have twice protested the violation of the zone. Once in the case of the dramatic Graf Spee incident, a second time when the German freighter Wakama was scuttled off the Brazilian coast after being detained by a British warship. A third protest is now in preparation. It is based on the case of the German vessel Hannover, which sailed from Willemstad with a load of lumber and ore and was overtaken by a British cruiser in Mona Channel between Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. The Inter-American Neutrality Committee is now meeting in Rio to determine precisely what shall be done to make this neutrality declaration effective. When this 7-man committee first convened in the month of January, no one was certain just how far its powers extended. Were its members to deal only in generalities, or could they attack problems raised by the declaration of the neutrality zone? The more conservative point of view prevailed at that time, and three rather innocuous resolutions resulted, none of which came to grips with fundamental issues. Subsequently, however, the Pan-American Union circularized the various governments, inquiring whether the Rio Committee should not be authorized to take cognizance of the new principle proclaimed at Panama. With an affirmative answer behind them, the Rio jurists are now in a position to discuss the problem of implementing the declaration. It must be emphasized that the use of force is not contemplated. No one wants to see the declaration converted into a boomerang, bringing war to the hemisphere instead of preserving peace. But methods short of force have been proposed in the course of discussions. For example, Charles G. Fenwick of Bryn Mawr, the United States delegate on the Rio Committee, has pointed out that certain facilities are ordinarily extended to visiting ships in port, not as a matter of law which they might invoke, but as a matter of courtesy. Were a specific vessel, therefore, found guilty of infringing the Panama Declaration, could not the American republics refuse to that vessel the customary courtesies of the port, such as refueling and reprovisioning? This would not be a violation of international law. It would simply mean withholding one favor because a favor which we ourselves had requested had not been granted. In today's cryptic announcement from Rio, the specific nature of the recommendation made by the legal experts was not described. My own personal guess would be that any proposal emerging from the Rio discussions would be along some such lines as I have just indicated. Another problem which confronts the American republics in the present world crisis is the adoption of a common policy to govern possible territorial transfers in the Western Hemisphere. This problem changes in aspect from day to day, almost from hour to hour, according to the kaleidoscopic shifts in European politics. When German troops invaded Denmark and Norway, they not only robbed Latin America of her profitable Scandinavian market, the loss is particularly serious in the case of the coffee-exporting nations, but they tossed the issue of Greenland into the lap of diplomacy. President Roosevelt has expressed his belief that this enormous territory lies well within the Western Hemisphere. He has indicated, however, that he views as both hypothetical and premature any question as to the application of the Monroe Doctrine in this case. Meanwhile, there are rumors that Canada might step in and take over the affairs of Greenland. Geographically, Canada belongs to the American continent. And yet, although she enjoys an autonomous status, she forms part politically of the British Commonwealth. What situation would result should Canada attempt to assume responsibility for Greenland? Would this run counter to the Monroe Doctrine? In the light of the administration's present policy, it seems probable that the other American republics will in any event be consulted with a view to ascertaining their attitude should a transfer of sovereignty in Greenland appear imminent. Greenland is cold and remote and sparsely populated. It has no great appeal for the average citizen of the United States, and presumably even less for the Latin American. But supposing that a German army were to march into the Netherlands tonight or tomorrow, what disposition would be made of the Dutch possessions in the West Indies, of the important oil refineries on the islands of Curaçao and Aruba off the Venezuelan coast? Or what, to pursue the hypothesis a little further, would occur if Great Britain and France, through the changing fortunes of war, were no longer in a position to defend their holdings in the Western Hemisphere? At Panama, the foreign ministers of the American republics resolved, quote, that in case any geographic region of America subject to the jurisdiction of any non-American state should be obliged to change its sovereignty, and there should result therefrom a danger to the security of the American continent, a consultative meeting such as the one now being held will be convoked with the urgency that the case may require. Unquote. It is quite possible that such consultation would result in a decision to place the territory affected under the protection, temporary or permanent, of the American republics. But what specific arrangements would be made for the administration of any such territory. So far as I know, there has been no formal discussion on the part of the American nations looking toward a tangible plan of action in this contingency. Quite possibly, two or three of the republics could be delegated by the others to act as administrative agents. The implications of such close political teamwork are fascinating to pursue. In these remarks, I have largely confined myself, as you will observe, to the political problems raised by current Pan-American collaboration. The economic aspects of the matter have been discussed on many occasions. I should like, however, briefly to call your attention to a body which is now functioning in Washington, with objectives which are chiefly economic, but with a widening range of action, which cannot fail to affect the entire fabric of Pan-American relationships. During the 5 months in which it has been in session, the Inter-American Financial and Economic Advisory Committee has brought forward at least two projects of unusual significance. One of these is a plan for fostering, through joint participation of United States and Latin American capital, certain Latin American economic activities which will not compete with our own. The second is a project for an Inter-American bank. The bylaws of this bank have been altered several times to meet criticisms formulated by various governments. About 10 days ago, a newly revised project was forwarded to the 21 capitals, and it is hoped that the convention can be signed by May 10th. The United States has already signified its support of the bank. Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, all three of which are important Latin American republics, have indicated that they have no objections to signing, and a sufficient number of other governments are expected to fall in line to make the experiment worth the attempt. Meanwhile, the advisory committee in Washington has amply demonstrated its utility in initiating projects of common interest. This committee was formed to sit for the duration of the war, and so far as I know, its continued existence after the war has not been contemplated. I should not be at all surprised, however, if the desirability of having some such permanent body available as an integral part of the Pan-American framework were to suggest itself to statesmen. The difficulties that stand in the way of a practical Pan-Americanism must not be overlooked. The 21 American republics differ materially in size, degree of economic development, racial composition, historical background, and culture. All of these factors militate and will militate for some time against an identity of interest and point of view. Among the Latin American countries themselves, rivalries and jealousies exist in abundance. Even greater is the gap to be bridged between Latin America on the one hand and Anglo-Saxon America on the other, with its size, enormous energies, and shifting record of cooperation and coercion. Despite the positive achievements of the good neighbor policy, problems of plenty remain for our diplomats. The issue of the Mexican oil expropriation has not yet been solved, and an even more delicate problem would be posed for the State Department in Washington, were the current presidential campaign in Mexico to terminate, as many observers predict, in violence and civil war. In connection with the oil expropriations, there has been talk of a possibility that Mexico might attempt to rally Latin American sentiment against the United States. Personally, I have no fear of such a development. For bargaining purposes, this implied threat is obviously a convenient weapon in Mexican hands. But the other Latin American republics, many of which are dickering for United States loans, are not likely to join in such a game. Nor do I believe that responsible Mexicans themselves would care to participate at this time in causing a serious rift in the Inter-American front. The world crisis is too real and too immediate, and our growing interdependence economically and strategically becomes increasingly apparent. To draw together the bonds that unite the American republics while there is still time would seem to be the dictate of common sense.
Mr. John I.B. McCulloch, Latin American associate of the Foreign Policy Association and editor of its Pan-American News Service, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association, 8 West 40th Street, New York. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. Today's broadcast came from Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.